Okay, we're talking about the purpose-guided universe with Dr. Bernard Heiss right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take some of your calls and continue the dialogue when we come right back. And the answer is probably very simple, Dr. Heiss, and that is to experience the physical in order to develop the rest of what is in the universe. What do you think?
I think it's very important to experience the physical. I think that's the purpose of the universe, is to give this great consciousness the possibility to experience what it is like to live as a being in a physical universe. It's a very interesting experience, isn't it?
It really is. And the more you begin to think that way, the more it begins to make sense, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't know if science and the spiritual folks will ever mesh, do you?
Well, I think they will eventually, because I think the truth will come out that we are spiritual beings. Now, most people who have faith of some kind or other already believe that, but I think it'll become part of the generally recognized this fact of existence by and by. And I think the fact that biology is the up-and-coming science for this coming century, that will have something to do with it, because biology is a lot messier than physics. And it opens up the possibility of looking at science in a less restrictive sort of way, less a way of thinking that, well, if we can't build a particle accelerator to make the measurement, it's not real. I think biology is going to teach us that things are a lot stickier when it comes to life, and that consciousness is going to play a central role that will be undeniable.
No doubt about that. And, you know, when we were talking last hour about physics facing a crisis today, what will get that crisis resolved?
You know, I'm not sure for physics, because if they find the Higgs particle, then to some extent, and don't find any other particles, then to some extent you've got the problem sort of solved. You have the essential particles identified, but you really haven't gotten to the basis for that. And it may be a conclusion that is somehow satisfactory, but still doesn't leave a whole lot of new exploration open. On the other hand, if the Higgs particle is not found, then that's a crisis for physics, because it'll have to find some other way to explain the nature of inertia. So physics is finding itself in a difficult situation, because it hasn't made any major discoveries for about 30 years. And the last discovery was the top quark, but we already had the five out of what were thought to be a family of six quarks. So finding the last one was a bit more of a relief than a discovery.
Well, they seem then to be against the wall. If they haven't made a major discovery in 30 years, based on the technological advance that we've had, something's wrong.
That's right. And there are a couple of books written about that, one by Lee Smolin, who's a prominent physicist at the Perimeter Institute in Canada, and another one by a mathematician at Columbia University called Not Even Wrong, playing upon an old statement of Wolfgang Pauli's, who made fun of things by calling them not even wrong if they were so bad in his view that they didn't even consider warrant consideration. These books talk about physics having hit a wall, and no new ideas are, in fact, no testable ideas. That's the key thing, no testable ideas being even on the horizon, because with string theory, you're in the untestable regime. There's not enough energy in the world to test string theory, so it's a bit of a problem to have that be the forefront of physics.
Let's go to Mike in Bend, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Okay, thanks.
Happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
I'm a first-time caller. I listen to you all the time, and I was watching the Ancient Aliens series, and it was really nice to put a face with your voice. So,
but I'd like face to for radio, huh?
I'd like to ask your guest if he had a chance to see that series and what his feelings are as to God having anything to do with, you know, ETs or extraterrestrials from anywhere else in the universe.
I don't know if you saw the History Channel's Ancient Aliens series at all, Bernard, but basically your thoughts of extraterrestrial life and God out there together jointly.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that there's life out there. I mean, with the discovery now of at least 500 or more than 500 planets in the last 15 years, we're discovering that planets are pretty common. And so there are going to be millions and millions of places within our own galaxy where life can originate and evolve. I mean, this is not known for certain, but it's certainly looking that way. So I think the existence of other alien civilizations in our universe, it has to exist. But in terms of things that are perhaps more subtle than that, the possibility that what we might be witnessing in this crazy UFO business has to do with the intersection of different realms. It's interesting that in string theory, we talk about multi-dimensions, additional dimensions beyond the ones we live in, beyond the three of space and one of time. We even talk about the possibility of other surfaces, multi-dimensional surfaces in those worlds that are, would be like universes. And so in string theory, you take for granted almost that other universes and other realms that probably would contain intelligent life can exist and be in a condition much different than we find here, because the laws of physics would be very different. Well, that's not a whole lot different than the religious traditions talking about other life forms in the context of angels and whatever. The terminology is different, but the concept is, in my opinion, strikingly similar.
Inasmuch as, at least right now, we cannot prove some of the things you're saying, I wish we could, will we ever get to that point?
It depends upon what you consider proof. You know, when I talked about the mystical experiences that people have had, they say afterwards, gee, what I discovered, what I experienced there is the most truthful, the most undeniable, the most believable thing I could ever possibly have. Not, I could more easily be talked out of my own personality than out of believing what I just experienced. It's sort of witnessing the ultimate truth in a way that is undeniable. And so I think that constitutes pretty strong evidence that there's something there that we are a part of, that we usually filter out of our lives, but that really is part of what we really are as beings.
Who was it? Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg, who once said that the universe basically seems pretty pointless?
He did, yeah. He
Jeez.
Made a statement 30 years ago that the universe, the more we discover about the universe, the more it seems pointless. And that was, in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I think that's a horrible philosophy to have. I think that's just very nihilistic. I just, that discourages me.
It's ludicrous to have. I mean, regardless of what it's out here for, I mean, to simply say it's pointless, and to me, he's negating his own existence.
That's right. It's a very nihilistic kind of way to look at the world, and I think that there are a lot of people that, you know, look at that and go, well, this is a very smart guy, and he is, a Nobel laureate, he is, and if he says it's pointless, gee, it must be. And, you know, I'm trying to offer people something more hopeful in my two books, The God Theory and The Purpose Guided Universe, because I believe that there certainly is a whole lot more purpose than that behind the universe and behind our lives.
Let's go to Roslyn, New York. Andy's on the wild card line. Hey, good morning, Andy.
Hey, George. Great show. This is a classic. Dr. Hache.
Yes.
Yes. No, I had listened to an interview with you and Art Bell talking about consciousness just about a week ago, and you're the first scientist I've ever heard that comes pretty much close to what I understand reality to be. Are you familiar with a book called Consciousness Speaks by Ramesh Belzikar?
No, I never heard of it.
You should really check out that book. It would really bridge what you're talking about. Anyway, I wanted to say that my idea of consciousness is pretty much what you have said, except that if you look at consciousness as a huge field that just is, then we are nothing but the characters within that field, like a holodeck. You know, if you're familiar with Star Trek at all?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. We're this world and everything we see, this universe, is like a projection within a holodeck. And for the purpose of the experience of the intelligence or the consciousness that created it. But that book, Consciousness Speaks by Ramesh Belzikar, I would highly recommend you read that. That is so close to what you say and goes into some other things that I think you'd find very intriguing.
Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure speaking to you.
Yeah, I think you're right that the consciousness that we have, the consciousness that we are, really is the same consciousness that is the source of everything. It's the thou art that is the fundamental truth, that the consciousness that went into creating the universe is the same one that we internally consist of. It's really what our essence is that consciousness.
These multiverse theories fascinate me, Bernard, in as much as what might be in these other universes? Is it echoing exactly our existence now, possibly?
No, in fact, I think just the opposite. The idea behind the multiverse is that you want to create, at least mentally create, the concept of many different types of universes with all sorts of different properties. Because what you want to do is to explain away the apparently special properties of our universe. And so you make up a whole bunch of other universes that are all radically different. You go, well, there's a whole ensemble of them. And ours is not special in any way. It just is the one in the within the statistical ensemble that happens to match our requirements for being living creatures in it. So they're all different, and they're different by design. And the number of universes you have to evoke to try to explain away our uniqueness is enormous. In one of the books on string theory written by one of the experts, he talks about one followed by 500 zeros. Can you imagine a number that large? characterizing the number of universes you have to evolve and evoke in order to have ours be not unique because it's just a part of a random set. I mean, that's a huge leap of faith. When, if I'm accused of making a leap of faith in a great consciousness, think of what a leap of faith it is to assume that there are 10 to the 500th power other universes out there that we can never see and never experience, and they're all different from ours, just so you can explain away our own uniqueness.
Absolutely. Let's go to Bashir driving in California. Hey, Bashir, you're up.
Hello, Mr. Nori. How are you?
Fine. Fine. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Nori. It was earlier you said that the actually I'm going to answer your question first, but I'm going to ask the doctor a question. You said that ants are actually what they would think about. Of course, every living thing, they know that they're being created by God. Sir, I am Muslim, and I believe that there is a hell, heaven exists.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors say it's okay to deny hell, to deny God. Well, what if Osama bin Laden kind of person do crime like that, killing a lot of people, or Hitler? What do you put God's position, doctor, as a judge, that how, if there's no hell, how are they going to get punishment for their crime? And also, you said that you can deny God. If you deny God, for example, if you deny your own father, say, hey, he's not my father, and everybody says, yes, he's your father, then how come you would, what do you think your father would go through if you deny your own God? You know that God exists and he creates everything. And thank you, I get my answer off the air. Thanks, sir.
Okay.
Well, I see God as being a totally benevolent being, so I don't see any need for him to punish us. I don't think he ever would. In fact, if we are God made manifest, then he'd only be slapping his own hand by punishing us. Now, it's a fair question to ask, what happens to the really rotten characters in the world? I mean, what happens to the Hitlers and the Stalins and the Saddam Husseins? Do they go to a hell? Well, I don't believe there is a hell. There is no hell and no heaven in my view. But what there is karma. And I think if you've committed the kinds of crime that these people have, you have probably some very unpleasant future existences in store because you need to learn the lesson of what you've done. You need to see what other people have experienced at your own hands. And so I think that while there's no hell, there's effectively a hell-like condition that you create for yourself, but it's due to the workings of karma, not a judgmental God. And as for having to pay homage to a God, I don't think this God requires any service from us. I don't think this God requires any adoration from us. I think this God loves us as extensions of himself. And if you choose to deny God in this life, that's fine. There are probably lots of new opportunities you'll have in the future to acknowledge God, but I don't think God cares whether you deny him or not. Ultimately, we'll know the truth, and we will be reunited with God, and we're giving God his experience in the meantime. So I don't see that there's any sin involved in denying God. I think it's just a matter of eventually seeing it correctly.
You sound like you believe in reincarnation, Bert.
I do.
Okay, me too.
I do.
Now, is it conceivable that each and every one of us, our souls, as we've evolved, I don't know how many lives I've had, but that very first life that we had, that very first moment, I wonder if we all evolved on such a bottom level. I mean, were we all what we would call evil people in the beginning, and then we got better and better and better?
I wouldn't say evil. I would say probably thoughtless people. I mean, I think the prime characteristic that you want to manifest or demonstrate as a good human being is compassion. Probably in our initial lifetimes, we were not very compassionate because we were not very mature. We didn't realize, it's sort of like a kid growing up, a baby. A baby doesn't know at first that there's an outside world. All a baby knows is its own requirements. Eventually it comes to know, oh, there's a mama and a papa and there's a world out there. But it has to begin to recognize that there's something other than itself. And I think when we come into these existences, our first ones are probably all about ourselves. We're wrapped up in that. And so we're probably not very compassionate. But, you know, hopefully, we're mostly not too bad either.
What are the odds of you getting a Nobel Prize for your work?
Well, with the kind of conversation we're having tonight, probably zero.
You never know. You never know. Why do you think science would hear you and go, oh, my God, what's he saying?
Well, probably so. I mean, I can imagine there's some of my colleagues out there, especially this show at night. You know, I'm an astronomer. And what do astronomers do? Well, they're telescopes at night.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the show is probably echoing through a few domes somewhere. My colleagues are going, oh, my God, what is he saying?
Well, yeah,
what are you talking about?
We're ruining your career. Nah. First, but we're selling you books.
You're selling my book.
Frank in Long Island, New York, first-time caller. Hi, Frank.
Hi, George. I love you. You're the greatest, and you changed my life. Conversations with God, to me, everything you're talking about and everything that's been talked about on Coast to Coast ties into that book. Tell me your take on that.
Conversations with God, of course, was by Neil Donald Walsh.
Yeah, I know. I read most all the series, actually, and I was on a show a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the question is, who was Neil Donald Walsh talking to, himself or God? And the answer is yes. Yes, to both.
Yes to both.
Yes to both, because we, in my view, we are God. We are God manifest, and if we look deeply enough inside, that's where to look for God, not externally. And so what I think Walsh was doing was, yes, he was communicating with himself, but was that communicating with God as well? Well, I think he was. I think it's a very insightful set of books, and I'm guided not by his claims, but by the answers he's given. If you read those books, you find that the answers that he gives to those questions, many of his questions, are not the sort of thing you'd expect. I mean, they're just not the kind of answers that you glibly expect if you're just looking to make a bestseller. They were answers that really were pretty profound in my view.
This tapping into consciousness that is available to all of us does incredible things. You know, we've all witnessed it. We all know people who have done some incredible things by doing this. In your opinion, is it easy or difficult to get into that groove?
Well, it's very difficult for me because I'm not a very experiential person. See, I'm doing all this purely from the intellect. I don't experience these sorts of things.
Really?
And I'm lucky. I'm married to a woman who actually does experience lots of things, so I get a lot from her. But myself, I'm a very intellectual person, and I don't meditate.
You're pragmatic, aren't you?
I hate to admit this on the air, but I don't meditate, and I don't have these mystical experiences myself. I wish I did, but maybe my role in life has been to come to an understanding of these things from a purely intellectual point of view.
But you don't have a closed mind to it.
Well, apparently not.
Albuquerque we go. New Mexico. Alex, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if you believe in beings in the universe that are conscious, that aren't necessarily humanoid, but made of electricity and stars or other celestial debris in the way that humans are made of or consist of smaller elements.
You mean like other life forms?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I certainly believe in other life forms, but it's hard to know. I mean, the chemistry of life based around water and carbon and oxygen is pretty rich. We know chemically it's a pretty rich set of things you can do when you start with those ingredients. Now, if you can start with something else and develop life forms, I'd be a bit surprised, but, you know, it's a big universe, and there probably are ways to do that. Silicon-based life probably is feasible. I don't know about, you mentioned stars. Stars are not a very friendly place for life to evolve because stars are very big balls of very hot gas that would render anything into pieces it's just not a very friendly environment, put it that way. So I think there's the possibility of radically different life forms. Even more interesting, I think, is the possibility of radically different life forms in other universes, adjacent universes, the sort of universes that are talked about both in string theory and in the Bible. I don't want to bring the Bible up as any source of information, but rather just to point out that spirituality suggests that there are other realms, and those other realms, for all we know, could be the very same realms that are discussed theoretically within string theory.
I wonder if anybody's ever stopped to think about the human being, for example, the fact that we have ears to hear, eyes to see, a nose to smell, a mouth to eat. I mean, to conceive of this machine that we call ourselves the human body, is absolutely remarkable. I mean, who would think of all these ingredients that we have to have in order for us to enjoy our senses, that we needed all those different things, and that we have them?
I think that's a product of evolution, though. I think that, you know, these things are not something that God sat around and designed and came up with his drawings and then made these things. Rather, it's the evolution over the billions of years on the planet. That
an intelligent evolution.
I'm a little bit reluctant to say that because that sort of smacks of intelligent design. I really don't want to be...
Well, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back and take more calls on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, great things ahead for Streamlink. If you're not a member of Streamlink, just go to coasttocoastam.com. For just pennies a day, you can sign up for that, and you'll get your downloads, podcasting, archives, and iPhone apps, and soon to be an Android app as well. Lots of great things coming. Yep, Jason, our engineer here, is jumping up and down with his Android. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, George Norrie back with you with Dr. Bernard Heiss, The Purpose Guided Universe. We're going to take your phone calls as well and your text messages, and I've got one coming in from John in St. Louis who wants your thoughts on reincarnation again. He wants to know where the souls come from, these new ones. I don't know if you're in the soul manufacturing business, Bernard, but it is fascinating where they keep regenerating, huh?
It is. You know, it's interesting that reincarnation is one of three things that even Carl Sagan wrote about that he said would warrant serious consideration. In his Demon-Haunted World, Sagan wrote that that certain EST experiments were worth pursuing, not that he believed in them, but they were worthy of investigation, or that people can somehow receive thoughts projected at them. Those are worthy of consideration. And the last that he wrote, that young children sometimes report the details of a previous life, which upon checking turn out to be accurate, which they could not have known about any way other than reincarnation. He says, I pick these claims not because I think they're likely to be valid, I don't, but as examples of contentions that might be true. And he was referring, I believe, to the work of Ian Stevenson, who was a meticulous researcher who spent 40 years, he was a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia, investigating cases of reincarnation in children who actually remembered lives that could then be verified by checking the facts against those with the family that still remembered who that person was.
For something, a scientist who's pretty pragmatic as you are, what changed your views? What got you thinking this way?
Well, partially it's just the logic of it. Does it make any sense to come into this world as a spiritual being and live for 80 years in a universe that has 14 billion years behind it, many billions to go? This doesn't seem very, very efficient to me. And also there's the problem of evil that we talked about earlier, and the problem of what happens or why good things happen to, or bad things happen to good people. And I think you can't possibly explain God in any kind of a way that has justice associated with it if you don't take into account other lives, because it's just too unfair. You know, if a child is born into this world and within the first 10 days, you know, chokes on her pacifier, go straight to heaven, that's the ultimate free pass. It's the ultimate, you know, go straight to the heaven pass. And that doesn't seem right to me. Whereas someone else might come into this world and be born into a situation where it's almost impossible to avoid a life of crime or something else.
Right.
So you can't possibly have justice, I think, in any kind of a world that implies that you only have one life. It just isn't possible logically.
Let's go to a Jim, truck driving in the Big Apple, New York. Hey, Jim, go ahead. Thanks for holding so long.
Hey, George, let me give you a toot.
There you go.
How you doing, guys? I'm just going to share the love, baby. How you been, George?
Okay, Jimmy.
All right, listen, Bernie, how you doing?
Yeah, doing just fine.
Okay, listen, I wanted to ask you about evolution because, you know, the Bible says in the beginning God, but evolution says in the beginning dirt, or we came from a rock. I just wanted to mention that. You understand creation science at all, because evolution and creation science are butting heads all the time. Like, I believe that 4,400 years ago, there was a worldwide flood. Everything died except for 8 people on the ark. And from that time till now, the math works for 6.8 billion people on the planet. Now, there's one other thing I wanted to mention, and then I'll just listen to you on the radio. But the process of desertification, how a desert is made, the largest desert on the planet is the Sahara Desert, and it's measured to be 4,400 years old, because it's really hard to have a desert under a worldwide flood. I'm going to hang up and see what you're going to say about that, okay, guys?
All right.
Well, I appreciate the call. I'm glad you're listening way back there in New York. I'm out in California myself. You know, you're welcome to your beliefs. I think creation science, to me, it makes no sense at all. I'm a scientist, and from my perspective, evolution is the key part of this God concept. I think that God wants something that's novel, that's unique. He wants creativity and independence, not something that depends upon his coming in and mucking around with life forms and burying fossils to fool the archaeologists. I mean, I think that would be a crooked kind of God to worry about if he's burying fossils to fool the archaeologists. So I just I don't have any. I'm basically sold on evolution.
How necessary is this experiencing of the physical plane for this movement into the conscious plane of consciousness?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question, George.
Well, you know, we physically have to have this existence, physically. We're here. Why is that important?
Well, I think it's because God has infinite potential. And that potential is one thing, but experience is something else. And so this is one particular type of experience. Not to say it's the only one. There could well be many other universes, just like you have in the multiverse theory. And those universes can all be very different and give God different kinds of experiences. And what would it be like to have an experience in a universe that has 7 dimensions instead of 4? Who knows what it's like? So I think this is one of many experiences that God seeks, because what God does is to create, and what he creates is, among other things, this universe of ours. And I think in this universe, it's necessary for these laws of nature that he's endowed it with to follow the natural course and lead to life forms. And that's why I think evolution is the key part of this whole concept.
Let's go to Portland, Oregon. John is there, and he's now up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, great show tonight, guys.
Thanks.
I just wanted to speak a little bit about what I think about the nature of consciousness, and that I think when you start out, you don't have consciousness. You have what I would call God fire. So that would make you alive as opposed to not alive. And I think it's our bodies that transmutate that into consciousness through our sensory experiences. It's also developed into an attention span, and that we choose our polarity through the karma and virtue that we acquire. And then when we die, this goes back to God, and it's more expanded this time. And that's what keeps God growing and seemingly infinite. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's true that what we're doing is providing something that enhances God in some way. I mean, there's a paradox here, because the wisdom traditions tell us that God is already infinite and perfect beyond anything we can imagine, that God is simultaneously greater than infinity and less than zero. God has no attributes, that God is perfection. And yet, somehow, this experience that we have, that experience that we are co-having together with him as living beings in this physical universe, somehow this is providing him something, I believe. So there's a paradox here, but I do think that our physical existence provides something that somehow enriches the eternal.
Okay, we go next to Shingletown, California. It's Roger's turn. Hey, Roger, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Okay, thank you.
You know, a lot of the time, I listen to Coast to Coast all the time, and a lot of the time, everybody's always talking about other planets and life elsewhere and all of that. And, you know, we have a lot of life right here. I'm American Indian, and one time I was with an elder, and we had we were just sitting there talking, and he pointed to a fly on the wall, and I looked at the fly, and he says, you know, that fly knows that you and I are sitting here. And if I wave my hand at that fly is going to take off. He knows, and he you're not going to be able to catch him. And he's able to maneuver around in this universe better than any of us, you know, for what he has to do. And, you know, I live really close to the earth. And, you know, those goats outsmart me all the time, you know. And a lot of times I'll go for a ride on my horse, and there's an osprey nest not far from here. And I've known that osprey nest for generations, and they fly over the top of me to say hello to me and coo at me and stuff. You know, and there's a huge amount of relationship that I have with nature, and I really think that, you know, we should look at what's here, you know. And I know the biologists do that, and the zoologists, and all of those people, but, you know, there's a whole lot right here on this planet that needs to be investigated, in consciousness and awareness of just the animals and the insects and the everything that lives and breathes on this planet. It has awareness, has consciousness, you know, down to the amoebas, to the whales. We don't even understand what's going on with the dolphins or the whales or the walrus or whatever. You know, there's an incredible amount of diversity of life just right here on this little oasis, this little blue dot. And I'd just like to know what you might think about that one, you know. I mean, we need to just look at our own planet and some of the stuff that's going on, you know, and we pollute it. Look what we've done to the oceans. You know, I really, that one program that...
Let's get his reaction, okay? Thanks, Raj.
Well, I agree with you 100% that the amount of life here is just staggeringly amazing. And I think this is, an example of why evolution is a key part of this. I mean, I think all of this came about through evolution because the right set of laws were laid down by this creative intelligence that is God. And as a result, look what's happened. So it's kind of the proof of the capability of this concept to make tremendous, tremendous diversity of life forms possible, tremendous different experiences for God possible.
Well, why is it teeming so much on this planet? I mean, he was right. There's an abundance of different kinds of life here.
I wish I knew that. I can only say with respect to his question of why look so much elsewhere, I confess to being an astronomer, and as an astronomer, I'm fixated on out there. But I certainly agree that the life forms here are just amazing. And, you know, I don't know whether on some other world, whether there is evolution taking place, whether we would be above or below average in terms of the amount of different life forms. But I wouldn't be surprised if ours were a particularly fluent one.
What's the main message you'd like people to walk away with from this book, The Purpose-Guided Universe?
It's that there's a purpose to your life. That purpose jibes with the science, that you can believe the Big Bang and evolution and believe everything that science has to offer and still come away thinking, yes, I'm a spiritual being and there's a purpose, and that purpose is for me to experience reality and to bring that back to God as a way to enrich God.
Idaho Falls we go. It's Bill's turn in Idaho. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Dr. Hayes, I'd like to direct your attention to an ancient book called Dialogues with the Devil by Taylor Caldwell. And in one of the essays in that book, it's a fanciful essay between Lucifer and St. Michael the Archangel. One of these dialogues, Lucifer's description of hell is a place where people mistake it for heaven at first because every wish and every desire and every whim is instantly granted. And it turns out to be such an uninteresting and boring place that essentially that's hell. And you use the word interesting in your some of your opening remarks that I heard, and that the universe would not be a very interesting place if it weren't for some elemental randomness. And it just startled me so much that I thought I'd bring it up with you. I'd like to ask another question while I'm on with you.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who took some physics courses a long time ago in college, I had this idea when I encountered theories of radiation and everything that if the universe was simply bathed with intense radiation, random fluctuations and coincidence of peaks of energy would somehow cause matter to come out of it. And that, I never had enough mathematical training to pursue that. But I wondered if Dr. Hayes would remark on how far off I was with this naive theory. And I'll listen on the air and get off the phone so somebody else can get on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't know that I can comment on the physics theory. I'd have to have a lot more information to comment on it. But I do want to comment on the first thing you said, which was that hell could be conceived of as a place that's infinitely boring. In fact, one of my chapters in the book opens with an episode from The Twilight Zone. It was a really acute episode from The Twilight Zone about this man named Rocky, who has been sort of a low-level crook all his life, and he winds up robbing a pawn shop and shooting a couple of policemen before he himself is shot dead. He wakes up in a place where he's with a character named Pip, and Pip says, well, what would you like to do? And so Pip manufactures for him all the pleasant situations that he'd like, and such as winning at gambling and the women there, and he wanted. Well, after a while, it gets very, very boring, extremely boring. Rocky finally goes, oh, my God, Pip, could you please send me to the other place? And Pip says, this is the other place. Very acute episode, but I think that makes the point. I think there's one good argument for why there cannot be a heaven. Anything that goes on forever is going to be absolutely horrible eventually. And so the idea of being in a heaven is something that will quickly turn into a hell. And so I see that as a big argument against any kind of infinite heaven.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. Bobby, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning. I would like to say that something that's helped me greatly in trying to figure out my place in the universe and therefore maybe my purpose is a little more is that I no longer think that I am the human experience, that I am the mental, emotional, and physical being. I'm thinking that I'm the space and grace of love that allows that human experience to happen. And I do observe it. In fact, I hope to be the spiritual vision for that and somehow balance out in evolution. Maybe there becomes a more of a balance between the spiritual vision and the physical or more human experience.
Well, there's a statement I think I mentioned earlier in the program by Chardin, Teilhard de Chardin. Surely we're not human beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a human experience. And that's what you're talking about. And I believe that's, I think that's the case. I think that says it right on.
The Wonderment of the Universe, The Purpose-Guided Universe. Where do you get the book?
The book's available on Amazon, of course, and Barnes & Noble, and should be in most bookstores, but Amazon's a good place to go.
And your website, I still have thegodtheory.com. Is that
thegodtheory.com, yes. There's more information about both books there.
All right, let's take some more calls here. Mike in Portland, Oregon, you're up with us west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Michael.
Okay, hey, great. Great show, as always.
Uh-huh.
My quick question is to Dr. Hayes. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. You, at the first of the show, mentioned billions of galaxies. And I think you meant zillions, or am I completely wrong on that?
No, within the Hubble Horizon, there are about 100 billion galaxies, each with about 100 billion stars.
The last I've read and listened to other people on the show here who were interviewed, the zillion category seems more, to myself at least, and to them, more accurate. Zillions, not just billions. Billions is what they used to use in the old days of stars in our Milky Way, and they've now upped it to 400 billion stars.
Right. 400 billion stars in our galaxy, but I was saying there are about 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and that's my latest information.
Okay, well, then I've misinterpreted the others, but I at least wanted to bring that up, see if I had heard wrong or something on it.
Okay, thanks.
Good show.
Super.
Thank you.
You know, I'm still perplexed by that incredible photograph that Hubble took of the deep zone, where, you know, it was like the size of a dime. It was all black. And then when you looked in, there were thousands of galaxies in it.
Yeah, it sure shows that the evolution of galaxies commenced at a very early time in the beginning of after the beginning of the universe.
Yep, absolutely. Next up, Roanoke, Virginia. William's turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, William.
Oh, yes. Good evening. I'd like to give my thoughts about hell. Well, heaven or hell.
Sure.
This is judgment. The world is judgment. Being in our bodies is judgment. And our souls, or our spirits, he likes to call them both one and the same, they can be split into many. One soul can be split like a cell into a thousand souls. And when a soul does wrong and it dies, it can be split into a thousand people, little babies born again, and die in a terrible way, the same terrible way that person or that soul caused injustice in their life. That's why you have so many people in the world today in judgment. And that's why they connect so easily mentally, because many people are one soul. You might have a thousand people.
That's an interesting theory. I never thought of it that way. But a soul could be a multiple. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Fast night.